everyone. Welcome to the Medicaid Innovation Accelerator Program, Supporting Housing Tenancy Series, webinar number 2. Can everyone hear me? If you have any logistic problems, please let me know in the chat and I can respond accordingly. So as I mentioned, please, everyone, mute your line. You can press *6 to mute your line and press *7 to unmute your line. We ask that everyone remain muted unless you need to speak. Also, do not put your line on hold, or else we will all hear your hold music. Remember that we will all get to hear that, so please do not put your calls on hold. To participate in a polling question, you'll need to exit out of full screen mode, and I will remind you of that when we get to the polling question. And you can use the chat box, as I mentioned, to ask questions if you're having any logistical problems with the webinar. Last but not least, this webinar is being recorded, so the slides and the recording will be available after the webinar. And now we're ready to get started. Thank you so much.
Everyone, this is Karen Yonis. I'm the director of the Medicaid Innovation Accelerator Program and happy to welcome you all to our second webinar. It's hard to believe we've been moving along and we've got a fantastic agenda for you today. And we'll go over the speakers and what to expect in just a moment. But first, let me start off by certainly giving you a welcome on behalf of the program and our center. I also want to make sure I introduce our IAP team here at CMCS, Center for Medicaid and CHIP Services. We have Mike Smith, who's the director of the Disabled and Elderly Health Programs Group, Division of Community Systems Transformation. And you'll soon hear from Melanie Brown. She's the technical director and lead of this IAP area, also with the Division of Community Systems Transformation. In addition to that, I know we have our other colleagues on the line as well who are working with us to deliver the right type of technical support through this webinar series. So next, let me introduce to you the speakers that you'll hear on today's call. So after Melanie, you'll hear from Marty Kinsley. She is with the Technical Assistance Collaborative. Next, you'll hear from Robin Wagner. She's the Deputy Assistant Secretary, Office of Aging and Adult Services with Louisiana Department of Health and Hospitals. Then we'll hear from Aaron Donahue, Assistant Vice President, Communication and Special Projects, Massachusetts Behavioral Health Partnership. And finally, we'll hear from Larry Gottlieb. He's the Director of Homeless Services at the Elliott Community Human Services in Lexington, Massachusetts. So we've got some great speakers from some fantastic states online for today. So next, I'm going to turn it over to Melanie Brown, who's going to walk you through the assessment.
Thanks, Karen. So good afternoon or good morning, depending on where you are. Just going to talk a little bit about the agenda for today's call, as well as just providing an overview of the goals of the overall tenancy webinar series. So today we're going to start with information regarding using the crosswalk for state strategy development, and then we'll have a time for questions and answers. Followed by Louisiana will be presenting a state example. There will then again be a period for questions and answers. Massachusetts will then also provide a state example. We'll have another period for question and answers, and then we'll talk a little bit about next steps.
Yeah, and I told her it's on the way.
So just want everyone to be aware of the date, particularly the date for the next webinar, which is April 27th. This slide just shows each of the webinars in the series and sort of the overall focal points that will be covered in the webinar. Please remember that the slides and recordings of the webinars will be available afterwards. We're working right now to
Do I need to email anybody or do you want to take care of that? Thanks.
So if everyone could just mute their phones, please. We're getting a little bit of feedback. So we will be making the slides and recordings available after. We're working on getting the
–
review the goals for the Supporting Housing Tenancy Track. Goal one, to assist states in understanding housing-related activities and services that will help individuals affordable and community-integrated housing. And goal two is to increase state adoption of housing-related services within Medicaid benefits for people who need community-based long-term services and support. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Jenna, who's going to walk us through a polling question.
Okay. So if you can see the polling question on your screen, if you can see it, you'll need to exit out of full screen mode. And the question is, what funding sources pay for individual housing transition services in your state?
Mm-hmm.
The options are Medicaid, state general funds, HUD sources such as DOC, other, not covered, or unsure, and you can select all that apply. So please click on those radio buttons and submit to show your results. Okay, if everyone wants to finish up, I'm going to close this poll in just a second. Thank you for your responses. And then we can move on to the next poll.
Jenna, before we go to the next poll, can I just ask one favor of the folks on the line? Just take a second and make sure your lines are muted. Thank you.
Okay, we're going to move on to the next poll. Same directions apply. The question is, what funding sources pay for individual housing and tenancy sustaining services in your state? Medicaid, state general funds, HUD sources such as DOC, other, not covered, or unsure. Again, select all that apply.
And this is Steve Eichen from Truven Health. I just want to give folks a little context on the polling questions. We're hoping that you've learned this, the answers to these questions based on the crosswalks that you may or may not have been working on. I know some states haven't had time yet, some states have. So to kind of show the range of funding sources available that are currently provided, and then as you complete the crosswalk, and as Marty Nicely is going to explain shortly, you can use the information on your current funding sources to identify gaps and figure out how to use your resources more efficiently. But we kind of thought it'd be good for all of us to see what other states are doing and what funding sources are currently under use.
okay. And if everyone could finish up with this poll, I'm going to close this one in just a minute. Thank you to everyone who responded. Here are your results.
Kenna, I think we can move to Marty. Hey, Marty, if you're speaking, you might be on mute.
I am on mute. Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. This is Marty Nicely, and I'm going to first just walk you through a few slides on sort of reintroducing the crosswalk, updating based on some feedback we've gotten. Then I'm going to put up a couple of examples of hypothetical or mythical states who have been working on a crosswalk. And for the purpose of looking at how to do it, not what's actually populated in the crosswalk, I'm going to show you, and then we'll go on to our state examples. Again, if you haven't started or if you're in the process of starting, I think it's always good to remember that the crosswalk is a tool. It is a it is one of a number of tools that you will probably want to use in your state as you expand the services available in support of housing and the housing itself. It is not the end. But rather helpful tools along with other tools. So defining what your goals are for using it, what you want to be your outcomes, always important. Once you finish it, you may have new outcomes based on your first round of the crosswalk. And, again, we're recommending that you do a crosswalk first on what exists now. Every once in a while, I run into a group of particularly stakeholders who want to use the crosswalk of where you want to go, and I think it's important, and most of you on the call today are state staff who understand the value of just really taking a really good look at, you know, where services are now. You can find overlaps. You can find gaps. It helps you identify silos, you know, what's coverable. You can begin that conversation with respect to Medicaid. I will come back to this at the end, but it's always good to have a reminder of who your audience is. And when you're talking about your audience, for example, for those of us on the phone, we use a lot of acronyms, and particularly when you're trying to fill boxes to do that, and then you share the crosswalk for purposes of decision-making with the decision-makers in your state, and you can see acronyms that across programs may not be understandable. So reviewing your glossaries, your terminology, descriptions of services, we think that one of the benefits of the crosswalk is that you'll find that depending on what the fund source is, you'll see different service descriptions, close, but often not the same. And then the same with contrasting and comparing your categories that might have different meanings, even among Medicaid programs within your state. And I can remember doing a crosswalk with a state where a really outstanding person who understood home and community-based services was the person who came to the meeting, but she was really an expert in her area, but not in other Medicaid programs. So it's always good before you begin or as you get started to review, you know, categories, at least have them in hand when you begin to start. Then I've added here a suggestion that, let's say you finish a crosswalk once, then I would do some process mapping or decision analysis because with supportive housing, we're beginning before someone moves in. And then you have a point of someone moving into housing typically, and then hopefully permanent housing. And even with permanent housing, people's service needs may change. So how do those changes happen? Remembering that supportive housing is often defined as set in one place and time, but in the world that you live in, it's across a period of time with many different players involved, many different rules of engagement, so to speak. I think it was Steve Eichen who also termed the phrase when we were beginning to talk about the purpose of the crosswalk being to discover the nuances in coverage. So I think that's one of the goals that that you will have in doing this. Also, then, before you start, it would be great for participants in the process to come prepared to talk about service rules and flexibility. We're pretty good at describing the rules, but I think this gives us an opportunity to also describe the flexibility in programs. You will see a couple of boxes on the crosswalk regarding financing. So, again, participants in the process coming prepared to discuss some of the financing rules, the business rules associated with a particular program. And then, you know, whatever exercise we're involved in, what are the ground rules on how to be clear with where you're going? It's often we'll get stuck. If you've got 3 weeks to finish a crosswalk before you have to turn it in for decision makers, remember that there's always a parking lot to come back and fix areas where you might be stuck, and then to make sure that you have at least some consensus on approach going in. So before I actually go to the actual looking at a crosswalk, it's going to be displayed on a spreadsheet. It's not real. What I'm giving you is not real. And it's not a final work product. It's just to highlight some questions that have come up from participants on issues that they're running into with the crosswalk. So it's a hypothetical or a mythical state, and this is there's actually going to be the state that I'm going to show you on pre-tenancy. It's actually slightly different than the state I'm going to show you on tenancy, where you can see, and you could see from the poll today, that many states have taken advantage of federal grants, state funding, state services, and Medicaid in conjunction with affordable housing, and you've pieced those together, sometimes at the project level, not at the systems level, together to create supportive housing for particular populations, sometimes across populations, or eligibility groups, Medicaid, for example. I think we had a question earlier about the VA, which obviously is Veterans Administration is getting involved in a very large way today in supportive housing and to factor in as well in your crosswalk. So the other thing I would say before we take a look at this is that in the past, and there are some real veterans on this call, I've seen your names, where you had a chance to start a supportive housing project, maybe using COC funds in a local community. And I think one of the major purposes of the IAP program overall, as well as this crosswalk, is to take a look at some more systemic approaches to going to scale with supportive housing in your state. So I'm going to share. There is a pre-tenancy crosswalk, and I won't be able to go all the way through every item. We just don't have time to do that today. But I wanted to show you some examples. And on the pre-tenancy, the first example, and if there are folks on from Oregon, big shout out to Oregon. Oregon sent in their work to date, and they had color-coded their various, it says black here, but it's actually blue, Medicaid, and the different, and you see here Medicaid authorities, different Medicaid methods for funding, statewide, and so forth. And then in this particular hypothetical state, you'll see the Department of Behavioral Health, which has both state allocations as well as grants. And you'll see a Department of Community Affairs, which in some states is the is the state agency that manages the balance of state or continuum of care programs. So it's not always called Department of Community Affairs, but in my mythical state, that's what it is. A couple of things that I highlighted here. One, you'll see a reference to the CABI grant that in my mythical state expires, and at least the federal funds in 2017. So one of your goals may be to find how that that particular grant can be sustained as part of the work that you're doing. On the green here, the Department of Community Affairs, these are federal grants. They come into the state, but there are also sub-state grantees that get HUD allocations, not just the state grantees. The sub-grantees may operate those programs differently, may have different strategies that they employ, and within those strategies, even though they're following a common nomenclature from HUD, there may be different approaches in terms of, you know, what's actually in a service contract and so forth and so on. It's, again, just not being able to do a deep dive here, but often it's going to be, you will see that even when you're talking about one type of grant or a general fund allocation, that there will be differences in service descriptions and differences in approaches at the local level that would goes to the question later on, not as part of the crosswalk, but an outcome of the crosswalk, what's the capacity building that needs to be done in your state? What is the work that you need to do to get to common definitions once you have approval, for example, to change and use funds under a particular Medicaid authority? So, again, the crosswalk is in large part about the how. How are we going to go forward once we've populated the various categories? In the in pre-tenancy, which is the slide that I have up here now, you may run into a category like conducting a screening and assessment that may look different in terms of what you're screening for or what that assessment looks like by fund source. That's not shown on my chart because that would, again, be a somewhat deeper dive than what I'm showing you right now. But it's always, again, at the end of the day, one of your goals is that common understanding, common terminology helps with the financing aspects and getting approval for Medicaid or other sources. You'll see down here that I've highlighted assisting with rent subsidy application and certification. There's only one Medicaid program that references assistance with this particular item. And the way it's written, assisting with rent subsidy and application, if you were doing a rehab service, for example, under the rehab option, say plan service, that language for assisting with a rent subsidy may not look like that, because what you're doing is it's individualized to the person, where you're assisting the person to complete a rent subsidy application and meet the requirements. So some, I think that's an important point, because often we run into a situation where one particular authority may be allowing you to do this at this work in one way, but when you're referencing a different authority, it may be different. Let me switch now to the tenants example. And I didn't color code this one.
I had to open it up.
Have you got it open? Is it there? Okay.
Thank
and
you.
This is a different state. I wanted to show, I wanted to highlight a health service in particular. The state has an 1115, and so they have a health care for the homeless demo in one area of their state, the metropolitan area. And that's made possible through a program. But it may not be. That's important that when you're, again, coming across the line here on providing early identification and intervention in this particular demo that's available, which means that if you see here in this small box where I highlighted it, where it says C Services Glossary for additional information, I would also suggest to you that when you're going through the crosswalk itself, that you've pulled up the definitions. You may want to have them as attachments, not necessarily part of your crosswalk, but when you're doing the exercise, putting those up, it might be a different crosswalk where you're just saying, okay, you've got this particular service providing early identification and intervention. I want to see by fund source what that definition looks like. So again, doing one, you may be doing multiple crosswalks. Crosswalk is a process, it's a tool, it's used in engineering, it's used in all kinds of different ways and different different work that's not just in our work. We didn't invent this term, but we're certainly, I think, taking advantage of it. So again, you'll see across. Add detail and plan requirements, eligibility by population. This is where we often see running into slightly different definitions, again, by fund source or at the state level or at the federal level, and it's really important to understand those differences and how that may affect going forward. Also, just to point out, the eligibility requirements for certain grant programs, federal and state grant programs, the eligibility may be quite different than the eligibility for a Medicaid program. And so you may actually see a person being eligible for three or four different Medicaid programs, but only eligible for one housing program. Very important distinction to make when you're going to the next step. So, again, what agency or organization provides or delivers this service? You could have a very long list. You will have some organizations who provide this service at the provider level. They may be providing multiple services, Ryan White services. They might be providing health services, behavioral health. And so it's maybe tedious, but in work that you would do outside the crosswalk is what's the universe of providers and what do they qualify for? What are their provider requirements? And then what would be supportive housing requirements that would be important even under particular eligibility requirements? I think my colleague Robin Wagner may speak about this shortly, where you would get into a lot more detail. So there's lots of nuances in the process of actually doing these crosswalks. I'll mention just one more before I finish. you'll see down under other individual housing and tenancy, sustaining services. I only put two lines with arrows up here, but as you can see, specify personal care, home health, teaching and modeling activities of daily living. This could go on. This list could go on for a while. And then, without going cross-eyed here, sort of tying that to each of the authorities and what would be what's approvable, what is coverable now, what could possibly be coverable in the future. And then if you weren't cross-eyed doing that, you would come over to, you know, how is it paid for and what is the criteria. So, again, I think it's important to remember that that the crosswalk itself, you may have a core group of folks who are working on the overall crosswalk, and then you may have other crosswalk activities or other activities or using other tools to actually get to what you want to accomplish. Completing a crosswalk, while it might be a huge job, is not the end game. So when you're finished, asking yourself, you know, can you achieve the purpose that you set out to achieve with what you've done? What else do you have to do? What needs to be done then? How will non-coverable, and I mean by that non-coverable Medicaid, services be financed and delivered? That is, if that's not a question that you're asking yourselves when you're finished, particularly when you're talking about some of the discrete Medicaid authorities, that's going to be very important. And it's different when you're talking about fee-for-service programs that are now funded and delivered and managed outside of managed care. And it may be a different question when you're talking within managed care. And as you all know, we're rapidly moving to a mostly managed system in Medicaid. So what's going to be covered, what still needs to be done. Are you prepared to go the next step? And what else do you need to do to be prepared to do that? Coming back to the beginning, who's your audience? If your audience is your state budget director, may be different than your stakeholder groups. You may have two crosswalks, hopefully with some internal consistency with respect to audience. What do they need and in what format? What format do you take in when you're pleading your case for additional funding versus what format when you're talking to provider groups about service definitions and service qualifications? What's your timing? How do you put all of this together? And then finally, who is your champion or hopefully champion in whatever endeavor undertaking? So that is the Cliff Notes version, if you will, of work to be done on crosswalks. And I think we have just a few minutes for questions right now. I don't see anything in the chat room. So I'm going to, I think, unless there is a question at this point, go next to Robin.
Actually, Marty, we have one question in the chat room, and then we'll open it up for folks if they have some verbal questions.
Okay.
So Betsy Benito asked, is the chart or version of the crosswalk also asks the type of setting, location, where services are allowed to be delivered?
That's a very good point. Yes, that should be it. That's not one of our columns, that would definitely be. And by the way, I think there's probably several more of those kinds of questions that you can ask with respect to what's missing in a column or what would be added to a column. And again, I would say a specific service, who's allowed to provide it and where they're allowed to provide it and how much they're allowed to provide. We didn't have a column necessarily for the extent to which a service might, you know, how many hours or, you know, how is this utilization management going to be performed. So I think you could add additional columns or you could put those under a specific column.
That's right, because I remember we tried to make this, you know, something at least to get folks started to think about what's covered and what's not and where you can find opportunities, because there's much, we can go much deeper for certain. I'd like to open it up to folks on the line if you want to unmute your line. Jenna, if I remember correctly, it's *7 to unmute. Is that correct?
That's correct. You can *7 to unmute your line to ask a question, and then *6 will mute you back.
Great. And I know a couple states that had questions in between webinars, and if those states want to speak, you know, to whether their questions were addressed or if they have additional questions at this point, it would be good to hear from them or really anyone else. I want to open it up for states to ask additional questions they may have.
And Steve, I think we were going, you know, questions can come in after today as well, I think.
Certainly. And, you know, one question I'm surprised I haven't seen yet is whether the examples that Marty produced will be available. They will. We will need a couple days to make them 508 compliant, but then we will make them available along with the slides.
One question.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I just one, you know, really big caution. Again, I ask folks to look at those as hows, not whats, because the these are meant to be to show you sort of the nomenclature and how we populated it. But this is not a real state. And so I just wanted to make sure folks knew that.
Hello?
Yes, please.
Yeah. For those of us who are on the phone, how can we get a version before the 31st? I think the due date is tomorrow.
We won't. We're not enforcing the due date because we know you don't have all the time and information you need.
No.
And so you will have more time. This is really a tool for you all.
Okay.
So
we just want to see Marty's version before we finalize ours.
Yes, and at the latest, it will be available next week. We will send it as soon as possible, but next week would be the latest that it would be available.
Hi, this is Jonathan McVeigh from Pennsylvania. I was wondering how other states were approaching their interpretation of the services and whether or not they were actually included in their state plans. So, for example, we were going to, at least for our first stab at it, interpret the services very narrowly. So are they literally in the state plan? And I was just wondering if other states were using the same approach or if they were doing something different. Thank you.
Thanks, Jonathan. And I'd like to open up that question. I know Connecticut, North Carolina, and Oregon have sent crosswalks in, so I don't know if any of you all are on the line and would like to talk about how you've done it or other folks who are in the process and would like to talk about their approach.
While people are lining up, I would recommend that you start with where you are narrowly, John, because that I think it's it gets confusing to say, well, does this really exist or not? That, I think, is probably there's the starting where we are, and then there's the second crosswalk, and that is your new plan or your new system. And since states are I don't know of a state right now that's not planning some kind of change in their Medicaid program. So I think that this particular exercise, I don't believe it's ever a one and done. It's something that you would come back and use as you expand or think about services differently. So I don't know if we've got other states to respond to John. They're looking at.
Excuse me. This is Oregon, and I can try and answer that from our perspective. We feel that this process has been a collaborative effort between the state Medicaid authority, the housing authority, and then the Department of Human Services. And the state Medicaid authority serves people with mental health challenges, while the Department of Human Services serves people with aging and the people with disabilities population, as well as people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. And I can speak more authoritatively about what the Medicaid Authority, the Oregon Health Authority, does. We contract all our services and supports out locally. And what we've done is we've tried to retain enough flexibility in these different plans like the I-Plan and in some of our fee-for-service language so that it depends on how creative the contractor is. And so a lot of these services can be legitimately provided under case management or some kind of skill building. So it really varies across the state. Did you want to add anything? So I think that's kind of a real quick, down and dirty description of what's going on here.
Thanks, Rick. I really appreciate that.
And thanks for your color coding. There was a question that just came in about services have multiple programs, which could be confusing. I absolutely agree. And I've seen crosswalking, I'm using it as a verb now, used for programs as well as services. I think there's several different ways to do a crosswalk. This is, in some respects, for most people, this would have been generally the way to approach it. But I would recommend that when you're a service, the multiple programs. That's why I like the Oregon approach with the color coding, and then as you go further into it, being able to say, and that's part of why you're doing this is that you've got a service, and then you've got multiple programs that might be funding it differently, and even though you may want local variation. If you are going to have some common rules of the road with respect to, you know, developing a person-centered or recovery plan or having a service be part of a service plan, treatment plan, that's going to be pretty much standard regardless of fund source. But you would allow some variation there. So there's various different ways you can try this. There's not a single approach to crosswalking. Other thoughts, challenges, and feedback?
Great. Thanks, Marty.
Thanks, Marty.
And I think now we'll pass it on to Robin Wagner from the Louisiana Department of Health and Hospitals to talk about how they are covering tenancy supports within their Medicaid program.
Hi, this is Robin. And first, let me confirm, could the chairperson confirm that I am audible?
Yes, Robin, I can hear you.
Okay, that's great. And I'd just like folks to know that here in my office with me today are Michelle Brown, who is our Louisiana program manager for permanent supportive housing and who makes the program work on a day-to-day basis, and Nicole Sweezy, who is the executive director of the Louisiana Housing Authority, which is our primary partner in this initiative on the housing side. So they are the real experts, and if the questions get down in the weeds, they're available to help field those questions. I'm going to start off with the definition of permanent supportive housing in Louisiana. For us, permanent supportive housing combines deeply affordable rental housing. I might add that it's deeply affordable, high-quality, community-integrated rental housing, plus voluntary, flexible tenancy supports. And I'm going to use the term tenancy supports throughout this presentation to refer to those activities that help people access housing and maintain their access to housing. In Louisiana, we use a housing-first model. That means that your tenancy is not contingent upon you accepting services. It's not contingent upon criteria like you're clean and sober and compliant and seeking employment. You maintain your housing regardless of those things. Your tenancy is really based on you complying with the terms of your lease and not being evicted, as it would be for anybody renting housing. I'm going to provide a little bit of history of our program. This is a program that started in the wake of the 2005 hurricanes in Louisiana. And I have to say that we had a lot of assistance from folks such as the Technical Assistance Collaborative. Marty Nisley was among them. The Melville Trust, a number of organizations. I really can't go into it, but we were really fortunate to have that assistance at this time of crisis. And the crisis became an opportunity for us to start this program with the goal initially of creating 3,000 units of permanent supportive housing. Our first units were occupied in 2008. We received a special congressional allocation of rental subsidy vouchers in 2008, and we accelerated lease up starting around 2010. Initially, we relied on disaster-related resources to get this program up and going, primarily a special allocation of low-income housing tax credits to the state of Louisiana and a special allocation of community development block grant funding from HUD for disaster recovery. However, from the beginning, despite the generosity of those resources, we recognize that the CDBG funds in particular were time-limited and that for long-term service sustainability, we would have to find a way to cover service for many, if not most, participants in permanent supportive housing under Medicaid. And what we recognize, too, is that the permanent supportive housing program would have benefits to the Medicaid program. So that's our history, and I just want to, before I get into details, sort of talk about where we are today and the scope of our current program. We started off with this program in South Louisiana because that's what the disaster recovery resources were limited to. But at this point, we are statewide in our scope. We do have a cross-disability program, and I'll be talking a little bit more about what that means. But we are serving a population that has high levels of disability. As you can see, 70% of tenants have one or more disability. Have more than one disability, and then a 40% have three or more disabling conditions. We're serving over 2,600 households at this point, with an additional roughly 400 receiving pre-tenancy services, 2,600 who are housed. And then we are on target to house not the original 3,000, but actually over 3,500 households based on the rental subsidies that we've been able to obtain so far. And Nicole Swayze is certainly a big factor in our ability to get more rental subsidies to expand the program scope. When we started, from the outset, we had dual policy goals. One was to prevent and reduce homelessness among people with disabilities. The second was to prevent and reduce unnecessary institutionalization of people with disabilities. And that those dual policy goals were reflected in the coalition that came together to advocate for this program. It was a combination of homeless advocates and advocates for people with disabilities. And, of course, there's a lot of overlap in those two populations, given the high level of disability among people who are homeless. And we also started off with the principle of separating housing and services, or at least we early came to that principle. Some of the initial proposals for using the disaster resources involved having housing providers, developers, use CDBG funds to fund services and placed upon them the burden of finding people with disabilities who would qualify for the program. We very quickly got in there and said that that was really not a fair burden to place upon housing developers, that that's the kind of activity that was better performed by the state Medicaid agency and its partners. So our eligibility and priorities in this program reflect those dual policy goals. Basic eligibility for our program is that you have to be a very low-income household. A member of the household has to have a substantial long-term disability of any type. So we serve people whose disability is a developmental disability, a disability related to mental illness, substance use disorder, it could be a physical disability, disability related to chronic conditions, and aging. Children with a disability can qualify the household for our permanent supportive housing program. Within that broad eligibility, we do give priority, preference points, if you will, for permanent supportive housing units, individuals who are transitioning institutions such as nursing homes, ICSDD. We also include prisons, jails and prisons, as our part of our institutional definition. We also give priority points for PSH units to households that are homeless. The program is a partnership between two state agencies. We're kind of fortunate, I think, in that the Louisiana Department of Health and Hospitals, in addition to being the single state agency for Medicaid, also includes the operating agencies for developmental disabilities, aging and adult onset disability, behavioral health, and public health. That means that many of us who operate programs for these groups under Medicaid and under other funding sources are all under one roof, which has really helped, I think, with the collaboration. We're also fortunate to have a state-level housing authority to work with that is co-housed, coexists with the Louisiana Housing Corporation. The Housing Authority was actually created for the specific purpose of administering the vouchers for our permanent supportive housing program. But there's a real beauty in having the voucher administrator co-housed with a corporation that provides the low-income housing tax credits that are significant to our housing strategy. And that's the next thing I'm going to discuss is our housing strategy before I talk about the services. So our housing strategy combines the low-income housing, for many of our units, combines the low-income housing tax credit program with rental subsidy. The low-income housing tax credit program can be used to produce units that are subsidized down to a certain level of area median income. So we use the low-income housing tax credit program to get our units down to 30 and 20% of area median income. That, of course, is not affordable for folks who have zero income. So we do have the additional layer of a rental subsidy that makes all of our units available to our households at 30% of their income. All states have a low-income housing tax credit program. The way that we incentivize the creation of permanent supportive housing units is in the qualified allocation plan for the low-income housing tax credit program. We give points to developers who agree to set aside 10, 15, in some instances up to 20%, I believe, of their units for permanent supportive housing. We generally don't go above that because we want to keep this community integrated, but in some instances we do have some units at higher concentrations, and I'll be getting to that in the next slide. You can see in this slide the rental subsidies that we layer on top of the units that are subsidized through the low-income housing tax credit program. The result is that the vast majority of our units are in new and redeveloped properties that are extremely high quality, that are mixed income, and that include market rate units. What that means is that the people with disabilities that we serve are housed next to people who are professionals, who come from all kinds of walks of life and all kinds of income levels. And again, these are very high quality units with very many amenities. In addition to the units created through the qualified allocation plan and the 10 to 20% set asides, we do have 230 shelter plus care rental subsidies that are set aside for our nonprofits that that focus on serving the homeless, and in those few projects, as many as 50% of the units may be permanent supportive housing. By the way, the pictures in this slide are pictures of some of our actual participating properties. So that's the housing strategy, and if there are questions about that, we have Nicole on hand to correct things I may have said wrong and to answer specifics. I'll talk a little bit about the service strategy, and let me start off by saying a bit about what tenancy supports consists of, and I'll talk about this in three stages. As Marty said, you have to begin this work before the person actually moves into a unit. So pre-tenancy involves engaging the person. Sometimes it involves finding the person, if you're talking about someone who is homeless. helping them address eligibility requirements and barriers, helping them make application to individual housing opportunities, helping them clear credit histories that may be a barrier to their getting housing, seeking reasonable accommodation for people who have felony convictions or who have debt that needs to be addressed and that's related in some form or fashion to their disability. It involves taking them to actually see the units that they might rent and helping them make a decision about whether the housing opportunity is the right one for them. Move-in phase, there's also very intensive work in helping them arrange for the actual move, making sure that they have all the essentials, timing in terms of making sure all the paperwork is in and the basic amenities are available for housing before the person actually makes the transition into the unit, makes the transition from an institution into the unit, and then also helping them with the initial adjustment to their new home and neighborhood. In the initial phases of move-in, you'd be helping them also to know transportation routes and how to get to and services from where they live, help them understand the terms of their lease and how to get along with their neighbors. And then ongoing tenancy consists of furthering individual goals, helping them achieve those goals, addressing any crises that may arise around their housing, eviction prevention, those kinds of activities. In Louisiana, we are funding these kinds of services, these tenancy supports, under Medicaid through our 1915I for behavioral health and under several 1915C waivers. We have other funding sources as well that I'll be talking about in the next slide. But our strategy when it comes to funding the services under Medicaid has been to incorporate this service into all of our HCBS programs for people with serious mental illness, developmental disabilities, or physical disabilities under our age-disabled waivers. So in this slide, I give you of how we're funding the tenancy support. As you can see, the 1915I is very important to funding tenancy support services. Our 1915C waivers for the age-disabled also come into play, as do our IDDD waivers. We do fund services for some folks in tenancy through Ryan White funding. We use CABI for folks who have a substance use for chronically homeless households with a member who has a substance use disorder. That's helpful short run, but there are time limits on CABI, so we have to look at more permanent sources of funding for these individuals. We have a few individuals who are funded through VA. And the CDBG, which is also significant in funding services at this point, is that that's the initial services funding that we got as part of the disaster recovery effort. Now, many of those folks that are in CDBG, we believe, will potentially qualify for Medicaid funding of services, perhaps through Medicaid expansion, which will happen in Louisiana starting in July of this year. And perhaps as we look at them more closely for eligibility for 1915C waivers or for mental health rehab type services for those who have SMI. I also have a line here where we weren't able to, at the time we ran this data, identify funding. I have to say that that's because at the point that we were doing this analysis in December and January, we were in the process of transitioning behavioral health services into our 5 managed care plans. So I think there were just some issues and files coming over. Most of those probably will fall into the 1915I line of funding. So when I talked about what tenancy supports consists of, one of the things I failed to mention but I need to mention is that tenancy supports, done correctly, almost always involve some time that is not face-to-face, if only if it's only tracking the person down in an effort to engage them around services. But it can also, non-face-to-face time can also come into play if the provider has to work with a landlord around eviction prevention. Sometimes the landlord is no longer willing to talk to the service recipient and will only deal with the provider in terms of negotiation or eviction prevention. So this work is very intensive and inevitably involves some time that is not direct skills building or counseling with the individual. What I'm going to present to you are sort of two different ways of dealing with tenancy supports. Under the 1915 C waivers, tenancy support has its own service. It has its own service definitions. It has its own service codes. It is not part of some other service. It's not part of waiver case management. We recognize that you can incorporate these services into what case managers do, but our reality here is that our case managers probably wouldn't take this job on and do a very good job of it, considering everything else that they are involved in doing for 1915C waiver participants. So it's very helpful that under 1915C waivers, you can define tenancy supports as a service, and in Louisiana, we have. I think at this point we may be the only state that is providing tenancy supports as a discrete 1915C waiver service. Under our 1915I for mental health, we've done it a little bit differently, and I'm not going to get into whether we could have done it otherwise under 1915I, but the way we have done it in this particular benefit is made it part of CPST and PSR services to people with serious mental illness. But in recognition of the fact that there is non-collateral time, non-face-to-face time involved in delivering the services, we pay at a higher rate when our provider is working with somebody who's in the permanent supportive housing program. So, again, in Louisiana's 1915I, you can only bill CPST and psychosocial rehab, PSR, as for your face-to-face time. But if you're working with a permanent supportive housing client, then you use a modifier that is a signal to pay that service at a higher rate. I'm going to talk now about the providers. Because I think what we know is that this requires quite a dedicated effort on the part of permanent supportive housing providers. And so we have a lot of requirements that are placed upon providers that they have to meet in order to provide the PSH service, bill that particular code under the 1915C waivers, and bill the modifier under 1915I services. They have to, first of all, be a mental health rehab provider, an accredited mental health rehab provider. They have to contract with all five of our managed care plans. They have to enroll in all of the 1915C waivers under which tenancy supports is a service, because our 1915C waivers are not in managed care. They are outside of managed care and in fee-for-service. And in addition to all of those things, our PSH providers also have to go through training and certification with Michelle and her staff and contractors on how to deliver tenancy supports. And this has tended to right-size our provider pool. It's not as though all few hundred waiver providers or mental health rehab providers are also doing permanent supportive housing tenancy supports. And I think it would be problematic if they were. If that were the case, they might have a couple of PSH tenants in their caseload, but they wouldn't have the kind of critical mass that would make it worth their while to put in the extra effort that it takes to assist people in pre-tenancy and in maintaining their tenancy. So at this point, we have 15 providers. If we need additional providers, Michelle works with our managed care organizations and other community contacts and does recruiting when necessary. And providers can knock on our door and express an interest, but we do make sure that they are fully informed of all of the steps that they have to take in order to be a PSH provider. And, you know, what's implicit in all of this is that if you are a permanent supportive housing provider in our program, you have to serve all types of disability. You cannot limit yourself to SMI or DD or substance use disorder. You have to work across the board with all forms of disability. And as a result of that, we have a mix of PSH provider agencies. They come from agencies that have worked with rapid rehousing in homeless continuum, agencies that have provided waiver services typically, and agencies that have focused primarily on providing mental health services. Those various kinds of agencies have come to the table and gotten the additional qualifications and enrollments necessary to serve a cross-disability population. Here are the results of our program thus far. You remember those dual policy goals that we had around serving homeless households and households with disabilities. A little less than half of the households currently housed were homeless, and of those, half were chronically homeless. 10% of households we have housed were institutionalized previously. And this is just additional information. Of those that we're serving, nearly 40% had the household members had had a substance use disorder. We have good results. We have a 96% retention rate, and what we mean by that is that the household has had a has not had a negative outcome. We have had some folks move on from the program. We've also, because we serve older adults with disabilities, we've had tenants who die. We've had tenants who moved out of state. The numbers that we include in that 4% with negative outcome are people who were evicted from the program or were terminated with the program, I should say, are people who went to prison or had other negative outcome. So we've really had excellent retention rates with a very challenging to serve population. As our PSH providers get people stably housed, they can then begin to work with them on issues like improving their income. A lot of times that takes the form of assisting them in pursuing their Social Security disability applications. And 61% of our households in New Orleans, which is the major part of our program, have seen an increased income since becoming housed in the program. And this final bullet point is a little bit dated. We need to update the numbers. But back in around 2010 or 2011 or so, we ran this and saw a 20% reduction in Medicaid acute care costs. We are in the process of updating that analysis. But the goal there, you know, what we hope to see is that we continue to see a reduction in acute care and emergency room type costs and an increased use in preventative services. This slide, real quickly, is just to show you the amount of Medicaid penetration we have in our permanent supportive housing program, despite not yet being a Medicaid expansion state. Part of the reason that we have such high numbers of people housed and in pre-tenancy who already have Medicaid is because Louisiana is a state that will make the disability determination prior to the Social Security Administration making that determination, using the same criteria, but making that determination to establish people's Medicaid eligibility. So we're often able to get them covered under Medicaid before the Social Security disability determination is made. So, lessons learned. First of all, it was really important to ultimately get the buy-in from housing developers and providers. There was a lot of resistance to including points in our qualified allocation plan. The permanent supportive housing set-asides, we now have housing developers and housing managers, property managers, who are huge fans of the program and who promote it among their colleagues. And I think the reason we were successful is that we did not ask them to provide services. We make sure that we get the tenants in line for them quickly. We are willing to lose the housing if we can't get somebody housed quickly enough. We have time frames that we have to work within. And if we don't get people into a unit within a given time frame, that property provider is able to rent to someone else. They will give us the next available appropriate unit that comes up, but the thing is we're not holding up their ability to draw down rents. But that speaks to why it's so important to have the effective pre-tenancy services in there and intense work in the pre-tenancy phase, because landlords do not want to hold units vacant for long periods of time. We've also played around with centralized versus decentralized functions. We had waiting list management for various permanent supportive housing projects in different areas, managed at the local level. We've gone to centralized management of applications and waiting lists, and that actually has worked out better in terms of getting consistency in those functions. We've also experimented in contracting out some of the basic program activities like taking applications for permanent supportive housing and looking at whether people met the basic eligibility criteria. That was contracted out for a period of time. That didn't work very effectively. So at this point, that task is managed by Michelle Brown and her staff. And let me take a little moment to talk about what state staff do versus what our Medicaid enrolled and contracted providers do. Michelle's staff take the applications for permanent supportive housing. So that's an application that looks at, yes, what services you're receiving that establish you have a disability, but it also looks at what are your qualifications according to HUD criteria for the housing units and the housing subsidies that we have in this program. And Michelle's staff provide appealable notice people meet program requirements or not. Michelle's staff look at placing people on the appropriate waiting lists for the housing units that are in the areas and are of the type that they're interested in and qualify for. Michelle has staff called tenant services liaison that are available to landlords should issues arise that are not being successfully handled by the provider or the individual tenant. These tenant services liaisons can also step in to provide services if people lose their Medicaid eligibility temporarily for reasons such as not following up on their applications and so forth. So they're a very important adjunct to the services providers. So it's very helpful to have some staff at the state level that can perform these kinds of functions. I should add, too, it is helpful to have a pool of money, whether it be state general fund or CDBG dollars, to assist individuals who maybe temporarily are not covered under Medicaid. And a little bit about why the program has worked. I think we had that joint advocacy on the part of homeless and disability advocates, and that was both at the state level and at the federal level, advocating for the vouchers, and I don't think we would have had the success if it were not for the very great power of that advocacy. It's been extremely helpful to have Nicole and the Louisiana Housing Authority to administer a critical mass of vouchers for this program. We've got some 61 or 64 public housing authorities. Is that correct, Nicole?
Oh, at least.
At least. And, you know, if without kind of a critical mass located at the state level, there is a certain amount of effort involved in going around to public housing authorities, selling them on this program, and getting the commitment of rental subsidy vouchers. So we were very fortunate that not only do we have a critical mass of vouchers administered by Nicole's shop, but we also have Nicole's leadership in approaching those public housing authorities and getting additional commitments to this program. And it is such a great working partnership. I've got to give an example. So, for instance, when developers apply for those low-income housing tax credits and they check off the box saying that they agree to set aside units for our program, Nicole comes over to the Department of Health and Hospital here and sits down with us and says, I've got a developer who's offering this number of units, this is this number of bedrooms in the units, this location. And as a Department of Health and Hospitals, with all those operating agencies, we get to sit around and say whether we think the units are located in a place that has transportation and is where somebody in our programs will want to live, whether the unit configuration is correct for the kind of households we have to serve, all of those kinds of things, to say yay or nay to whether these housing developers will get the tax credits or not. So that's the kind of collaboration we're able to have at the state level. It's been very important to be able to combine the tax credit program with the rental subsidy. I talked already about the separation of housing and services. I'm not going to belabor that. And then I mentioned how important it is to have some state staff that can be a contact for the landlords, the property managers, the housing providers, that can resolve, get in there in a crisis situation and resolve problems. So I hope I've covered things thoroughly enough, but here's the question opportunity in case I haven't.
Thanks, Robin. And we have 20 questions in the queue and about 10 minutes before we need to get Massachusetts before we learn about Massachusetts. So I'm going to ask some of these a little out of order just so that we can kind of organize by topic a little bit.
Okay.
And, you know, we'll do the best we can and maybe touch base offline on those we can't answer in our limited time. Ken Edminster asked, what work was being done between the startup in 2005 and the first placement in 2008?
What work was being done is actually rebuilding housing in New Orleans, yes, and in,
right,
South Louisiana. Nicole?
But I would also add, with another allocation of disaster CDBG dollars, we created what was called a transitional assistance program that took people and gave them rental assistance for 2 years with those dollars, and we had actual contracts with the owners that they would agree after the 2 years of this transitional assistance that they would commit and take our vouchers, because we were just so adamant, everybody was, that we were going to end up with a long-term subsidy. So we ended up assisting 400-some-odd people with that program, and all those people transitioned onto our permanent voucher subsidy. But then creating a housing authority was no small feat as well, and so that was a lot of the work that took place too.
But it is important to note that literally we were having to rebuild and rehab housing in South Louisiana. There was a huge housing crisis in general.
Thanks. Next questions are around the tax credit. What incentives are provided to developers in the LIHTC set aside, and how are the rents subsidized?
Sure. So initially, any developer that was coming in for what was called our Gulf Opportunity Zone tax credits, they had to set aside 5% of their units for people in need of permanent supportive housing at 20% rents, because we didn't know that we were actually going to get the vouchers. And then once we received the vouchers, we're able to take their rents up to the Housing Authority payment standard, which is 110% of the fair market rent. When those GO Zone tax credits went away, our QAP developers could set aside 5 to 10% of their units for people in need of permanent supportive housing. And those are still at, they still have to make that initial commitment at the 20% rents as we are getting to the end of our voucher allocation. So outside of once we allocate all of our vouchers, we have a commitment to continue in our qualified allocation plan for the set-aside of PSH units, which means as long as there is Medicaid funding to provide the services, that we can creating a pipeline of PSH units.
And we will have households that can qualify and handle the rents at the 20%
right
of area median income, particularly as they are assisted to get their Social Security disability benefits.
Thanks. And what strategies, you might have addressed this already, but what strategies do you use to make sure the developments remain viable for 15-plus years if they set aside so many units? It sounds like one factor is there's a 5% unit set aside, but I want to let you address that question otherwise as well.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the vouchers that we have nice, we can do a 15-year housing assistance payment contract with a 15-year extension that layers over top of their 30-year use agreement with the tax credits. So I think that answered the question. If not, let me know.
Thanks. And now the vouchers, there's some questions about the vouchers and rental subsidies in particular. How did Louisiana target the Section 8 vouchers to the program?
Well, and I think that's where we got lucky with our special allocation of $20 million for 2,000 project-based vouchers and $50 million for 1,000 Shelter Plus Care subsidies, both of which are being renewed annually now, so that will continue to be a resource for us. So we are truly a very unique housing authority in that we only have project-based vouchers. There's no other housing authority in the country that has that. However, every housing authority that has a housing choice voucher allocation has the ability to project-base up to 20% of those vouchers. And, in fact, there's some new legislation that I've seen that's actually going to let housing authorities project-base more. So more to come on that.
Thanks. I know there was a separate question about whether the vouchers were tenant or project-based, and they are project-based.
Oh, right. So under the Housing Choice Voucher Program, they are project-based. And interesting, anybody that's familiar with Shelter Plus Care, which has now become COC rental assistance under the new HARTH Act, allowed for tenant-based, project-based, and sponsor-based. And we actually started off with all three components and have now, 7 years later, everyone is tenant-based under that Shelter Plus Care allocation, which gives some nice flexibility. Part of the reason our turnover rate is so low is because we rehouse people no matter what it takes, and the amount of time spent rehousing people can be greater than initially housing people.
Thanks. Now, are there any local PHAs participating in the program with their Section 8 vouchers?
Yeah, we have commitments from three local PHAs that were a part of our Section 811 Project Rental Assistance Demonstration Program. So we're in the process right now of working on MOUs with those three PHAs and how we're going to move that forward. But I'm sorry, there's also the Housing Authority of New Orleans has awarded project-based vouchers to developers that have PSH commitments as well. So they've been a long-time partner back to 2008.
Thanks. And how long, I know Robin mentioned the landlords aren't asked to hold the unit for too long. How long are they asked to hold a unit?
So we have a PSH set-aside agreement that we can share with everyone that at initial lease-up, we ask them, maybe it's 30 days. I'm sorry, the numbers are just escaping me. Maybe 60, and then no longer than 30 at turnover. And with the project-based vouchers, we pay up to 2 months vacancy payment at turnover, which is 80% of the contract rent. And the 811 program actually lets you pay 60 days up front. So at initial lease up, if it takes you that long to fill a unit, you can at least pay that owner 80% of the contract rent.
And 60 days may seem like a lot, but as anyone who's worked with nursing facility transitions and other complex transitions knows, things come up, and you may think you have a move-in date, and delays happen. So you know, it's still incumbent upon the provider working effectively with the person to get them into the unit.
Thanks. And one question about, is there a time limit to length of stay, the length of time a person can remain in the permanent supportive housing?
No.
And how are developers getting rents down to the 20%? I think this is actually a question we kind of answered already in terms of the 5% of units and the 15-year agreements that you have with them.
Essentially, it's the low-income housing tax credit that they get that helps them underwrite
right.
the units.
Mm-hmm. They have layered financing.
But, and one last question on the housing side of things, and then we'll get to some service. But actually, so how are you able to use the year-to-year renewals to support tax credit projects? Are investors concerned about the volatile nature of the annual renewal?
Well, investors are always concerned about where the funding is coming from. And all of HUD funding is always subject to appropriations, but you're talking about HUD's Housing Choice Voucher Program and their homeless programs that so far those programs have been pretty safe bets. And so that's just what I tell investors all the time. I'm giving you, on the Housing Choice Voucher side, a 15-year contract with a 15-year extension that gives the out clause should there not be funding available, the same on the 811 side and the same with the COC rental assistance. So
thanks.
I think it's an education piece for investors. You know, we have investors that we work with all the time now. We have investors that were fine once and now become skeptical, but you just keep having the same conversation with them.
Thanks. This is really helpful. Now, I know there's a bundle of service questions that I'd like to save. I'd like to make sure we hear from Massachusetts as well. We do plan on the waiver, an example of the waivers and the 1959 state plan amendment. Those are available on Medicaid.gov, and we will send links to the folks on the line where Melanie Sarnes put together a fact sheet on the programs that we want to vet with the state and then send to you. So that will answer some of these service questions as well if we don't get to them today. But right now I'd like to thank Robin and Michelle and Nicole for their time and pass it on to Aaron Donahue from Massachusetts Behavioral Health Partnership. Aaron, take it away.
Great. Hi, everybody. Thank you so much, first of all, to the folks at CMS and the organizers for having us on this. This is really exciting. We love to talk about CSPEC, so this is really great. And Marty and Robin, those were wonderful presentations, very informative. Thank you. So as Steve said, I'm Aaron Donahue. I'm the AVP for Communications and Special Projects here at MBHP, the Massachusetts Behavioral Health Partnership. And we are the behavioral health contractor for the state for the MassHealth PCC plan, primary care clinician plan. So we manage behavioral health for, you know, give or take, we usually have around 400,000 people that we are covering at any given time. We've held this contract with the Commonwealth actually since 1996. And the folks that we serve obviously are, you know, very medically complex, very vulnerable individuals. So I'm going to talk a little bit about CSPEC, the Community Support Program for People Experiencing Chronic Homelessness. So I'll talk a little bit about the brief history. I'll talk about how it works, and then I'll go into some of our results. And I'll tag team this with Larry Gottlieb, who is one of our great providers here in Massachusetts. So brief history and overview. CSPEC, it's kind of a funny acronym, but it rolls off the tongue after a while. So it was created in 2005, so over 10 years ago, and it was basically created through an advocacy partnership with the Massachusetts Housing and Shelter Alliance, and also known as MHASA, that's how I'll refer to it. So MHASA and MBHP got together and said, you know what, we want to find a way to improve care and reduce costs for chronically homeless individuals on Medicaid. And so a performance incentive was written into our contract with MassHealth as CSPEC. And I'm going to talk a little bit about how CSPEC relates to CSP. It's basically a part of our community support program. So it's community-based care coordination, it's tenancy support services, and then a little bit about who's eligible. So you have to be chronically homeless. And we use the federal definition of chronic homelessness, which is what you see on your screen here. This was, as most of you I'm sure know, this definition was just changed slightly, went into effect in January, I think. But basically it's someone who, with a disabling condition, who has been homeless continuously for a year or more, or who has had four episodes of homelessness in the past 3 years. So, again, that's been tweaked slightly, but that's the general population we're talking about. They have to have a mental illness and or a substance use disorder or be at increased medical risk. Again, these are very vulnerable vulnerable individuals. And a little bit about Housing First, which Robin touched on. That was a great, I thought she gave a great explanation of it. And just I can kind of add to that, Housing First is, as Robin said, it's not about being a good client. It's about being a good tenant. So it's very much you separate the housing from the services. But it also really flips the traditional continuum of care of homeless services on its head. And it says if you've got someone with mental illness, with addiction, with medical complications, they're not going to be able to kind of jump through the hoops of street outreach and detox and, you know, shelter and transitional housing. There's all, you know, it's very difficult to ask someone to get their life back together when they don't have a stable, you know, place to lay their head at night. So Housing First is really about putting the housing at the front end and wrapping the services around that person. So CSPEC is a companion to the Housing First model. So CSPEC was developed by MBHP, and the really exciting news is that with social innovation financing, which Larry can speak a little bit more to, but we have social innovation financing here in Massachusetts, which is essentially where private investors front money for a social intervention, and then if specific goals are met, those private investors get paid back with public dollars. And so with social innovation financing in Massachusetts, we've been able to actually expand CSPEC not only for those who are on MBHP, but those who are at the other managed care entities in Massachusetts, and there's about five of them. So now pretty much if you are in managed care on Medicaid in Massachusetts, you have access to this service. So that's really very exciting for us. So again, same thing. So, you know, the premise behind this is that when someone is in permanent supportive housing, they have that stability, they have that support, and they're better able to link up to resources and to services. So a little bit about the community support program. So that is one of our levels of care, and again, CSPEC is a subset of that. CSP is not clinical service. It is really about assisting members, improving their daily living skills, helping them link up with, you know, benefits, housing, medical care, behavioral health care, if they need transportation, you know, recovery, peer services. So it's really about, it's not so much about, you know, the clinical intervention as it is about getting the person to the clinical intervention. So the other part of CSPEC is that, again, Robin kind of touched on this, the strategic partnerships have been key. So we contract with 8 providers that are in our network, and they bill us for the CSPEC service. And then those partners also work with housing providers who have, you know, the available vouchers and state and federal funding for housing. So it's a great way for providers to be able to leverage. They might have money for housing, and they don't have money for services. That's where CSPEC is. And so in the past year, we had about 600 people participating in CSPEC. So CSPEC came about through the 1115 waiver, again, written in as a performance incentive in 2005. Originally, so CSP, so the kind of the parent level of care, if you will, is billed in 15-minute units, so one unit equals 15 minutes. But what we realized is that doesn't make a whole lot of sense for CSPEC because it really is more of a longer-term service. You can actually get an initial off for CSPEC is 120 days. So it's about an ongoing relationship with a case manager. And so what we did is we changed it to have one unit equal one day. So that's how they bill. So they can get an authorization for 120 days. Providers can also get an authorization up to 90 days before someone is in housing. But again, they've got to be chronically homeless. And they've got to be working with a case manager towards housing. You know, it's not about sort of just billing for the service and someone is terminally homeless. That's not the point. So that's kind of how it works from that perspective. Annual cost about $6,300, and again, that gives providers resources to pair with housing. In FY15, we spent about $2.38 million, and then the average length that someone gets services is 2.2 years. One thing that's come up kind of in conversations that I've had with Steve and Melanie before this webinar is the issue of dual eligibility. And so we're still working on that here in Massachusetts. If someone gets Medicare, then they are no longer served by MBHP. And so that's a little bit of a glitch, obviously, because once someone's housed and stable and they get the services they need, maybe SSI, then all of a sudden they lose this benefit that has allowed them to stabilize. So we're really working on that here. So this, I want to stress with this data that this is a very small, I think it was 295 people that were involved in this study. Very small internal study, you know, this is not gospel truth, but it gives you a sense, you know, it gives you a sense of just these dramatic reductions that we're seeing. You know, so this is based on actual claims data. So behavioral health went down, if you look in the first column, from $12,000 to $10,000. If you look at the utilization, that went down as well. The medical cost, that's an estimate. That's from the Massachusetts Housing and Shelter Alliance, and it's based on Boston Healthcare for the Homeless data. So you'll see the total if you look in the bottom right estimate is around $25,000. Now, of course, that's savings, but then, of course, there's a cost to the service. So the average cost, this is housing and services, you know, Mahasa estimates about $15,000. It's probably creeping up closer to $18,000 to $20,000 now. And again, that's everything. That's housing and services. And when you look at the cost of somebody on the street, I mean, take costs out of it, just their health in general, versus once they get into housing, it's just dramatic, really, what we see. And so we're looking at a net savings of about $10,000 per person annually. And again, if you extrapolate out, that's $3 million a year in savings. This is a really interesting slide, I think, personally. So this is an ED utilization comparison. 9 out of 10 had a decrease, and a very significant decrease at that. I mean, even if you look at member one, you know, the first column, 106, and then 2 years after, during their second year of CSPEC, goes down to 10, you know. So, I mean, even just looking down the first column, it's all double digits. And then you go down, you know, in the second column, you can see, especially in the lower half, it gets lower and lower. So the total went from 300 to 80. So that was about, I think, a 73% decrease. So that's what else? So, you know, I'm just looking at my notes here, make sure I got everything for you. So I think so that's kind of just the basic, very quick, you know, I know we're running short on time, too. So that's the quick overview of CSPEC. It's just a billable service. It's covered. It's in our capitation. You know, it's not anything special. It's just something that providers can call and get an authorization for. So I'll turn it over to Larry now, and Larry can talk about CSPEC from a provider perspective. So thanks.
Thanks, Erin. Can everyone hear me? Yeah. Great. Okay. So my name is Larry Gottlieb. I'm the Director of Homeless Services for a large behavioral health organization in Massachusetts called Elliott Community Human Services. We have about 1,600 employees. Our homeless program is statewide. We're the PATH provider for our state. We're the single provider, PATH provider. Massachusetts is very unique as one provider. So we're in about 50 locations, and we are a provider of direct services to homeless clients, and we're only talking about homeless, chronically homeless adults. We don't do family work. Most of the family work, almost all of the family work, is done here through two different agencies, our Department of Transitional Assistance and our Department of Housing and Community Development. It's a closed system. And so we're talking about single adults. Let's see if I can get this slide up. Okay, so we provide both outreach and in-reach to homeless individuals in about 50 locations who are largely in emergency shelter or living in on the streets or in places not meant for human habitation. And we operate within the broader mental health division here at Elliott. We have a number of outpatient clinics in a variety of locations. We do lots of work with our state mental health authority, which also, as most folks know, is the recipient of PATH funds that get distributed, you know, to our state. We are a licensed clinical agency, which allows us to bill our Medicaid managed care entities. As Aaron mentioned, we have five or possibly six managed care entities, covers about 1.2 million people here in Massachusetts. Those of you who work in the homeless realm know that Massachusetts in 2014 had the fifth highest number of homeless in the state. That includes both families and individuals, and our state has a population of about 6.6 million people. And so, and it's very cold here, so lots of our clients that we serve are in, you know, many different places in terms of sheltering. It's virtually impossible to live in Massachusetts in the wintertime and be outside, although we do have some, you know, rough sleepers. But more recently, we have contracted with the Mass Housing and Shelter Alliance for a SIF, or Pay for Success model, which over the next 2 years is targeting about 800 additional chronically homeless folks for these C-SPEC type benefits. And this is now including all of our managed care entities. So we started out with just with Aaron's organization, the Mass Behavioral Partnership under the carve-out, and now we've expanded under Pay for Success to all of our other managed care entities. It's a rate between $17 and $17.50 a day, 7 days a week. The agencies that we work with are many times receiving HUD COC dollars. We have 16 COCs here in Massachusetts, small state, lots of advocacy on the COC level. And so the our partners are shelter providers, some affordable housing providers, and we are now billing for about 275 clients who are permanently housed. You can see from the slide, 113 are in the Pay for Success program and 162 in C-SPEC. That's just Elliott. There are other agencies who can do third-party billing. Some of our shelters have licenses to do that, but we're working with a number of entities who cannot do the billing because they're not licensed, so we have the capacity in our billing department to do that. We have a very simple system to gather the information. There has to be a diagnosis, as Aaron described, whether it's, since it's a behavioral health program, many of our managed care entities partner with a number of behavioral health organizations in order to provide behavioral health services. And right now, C-SPEC is totally in the realm of behavioral health, so a DSM-5 diagnosis is required, and again, as Aaron mentioned, the agencies that we work with, we can start working with people pre-housing, and the amount and the intensity and the acuity of the service really depends on the individual. So once the housing is identified, a case manager might be spending much more time with an individual, working with a landlord, getting, providing assistance for a variety of benefits. Again, like Robin said, under a very low threshold environment, it's not a requirement for a person to be engaged in mental health treatment or addiction treatment in order to get into the program. And that's really the work of the case manager, is to get folks connected with benefits and other kinds of clinical supports. Aaron mentioned that because of our situation here with dual eligibles, that some of our folks who become SSDI eligible and achieve a Medicare benefit that terminates the C-SPEC benefit, we're working with our state Medicaid office to change that because it does impact the number of clients that we've worked with who've been housed. They're in the programs, they're getting services, and you know, after the 2 years of receiving their SSDI benefit, they become they achieve Medicare and become ineligible. So that's something we're working on, you know, fixing here. You know, in terms of the housing, again, Massachusetts has 351 cities and towns. We have about 240 public housing authorities here in a very small state. We work with many of our housing authorities, but a lot of the housing that's actually put up by our partners comes from their own access to some state voucher programs. We call it the Mass Rental Voucher Program, the Section 8 programs for the clients to get access to the housing. My staff are largely clinicians who are working in the shelter, so often my staff have become familiar with many of the clients who are being targeted for permanent housing. You know, we can provide a lot of consultation and support to folks as they prepare for housing. And so there's a nice sort of continuity between what we're doing kind of at the grassroots level, whether it's outreach or in-reach in shelters, and, you know, clients get handed off to case management for the long-term services. You know, most of our clients, I was really impressed with Robin's numbers. 94% of clients who are staying successfully housed here in Massachusetts, our rates across the state are somewhere between 80 and 85%, in some cases a little bit higher. So the results are dramatic. And, of course, you know, again, we have a $40 billion budget here in Massachusetts for our state, and $15.5 billion of the 40 is in the Medicaid program or MassHealth program, which is about 40% of our entire budget. It's not a sustainable number. You know, most of what we're trying to do is redirect care to more appropriate outpatient services, shift people away from emergency care, you know, get them connected to, you know, ongoing behavioral health, substance abuse disorder, and medical services. And, you know, I've been here in Massachusetts for the last 18 years and involved with Healthcare for the Homeless as a director in the middle. We have six Healthcare for the Homeless grantees here. And, you know, we're really making a push to get folks connected to permanent housing and services and keeping people in more appropriate levels of care and try to, you know, reduce our total cost. And the biggest problem here is in terms of housing, is that housing is super expensive here in Massachusetts. Finding landlords who are even willing to take some of our vouchers has been a challenge. Most of the, you know, cheaper housing in our state is now being developed for market rate housing. You know, lots of people come here to go to school and stay on to live here permanently. So that's been the biggest challenge. But our partners are usually creative in terms of their ability to create some additional housing, attach clients to vouchers so that our folks who are largely on some type of disability benefit, our state actually has a general assistance program, which is a very low a financial benefit. But you know, we're seeing some great results from CSPEC and our PFS programs, and you know, we hope to continue. So that's pretty much it.
Great, thanks, Larry. So I'll kind of wrap it up, and you know, I think, you know, CSPEC is, I think Larry summed it up, where it's about redirecting, you know, it's about better care at a lower cost for a very, very vulnerable population. So it's really a clear way to attain the goals of the triple aim: better quality, better care, reduce costs. We do have data, you know, showing that the majority of members reported much improvement in their lives. We did win back in 2010. If you want to Google it, you can Google Pioneer Institute Better Government Competition 2010, and then you'll see actually the whole paper. We won like the grand prize, and you'll see the whole paper that kind of explains CSPEC in even more detail, and perhaps the organizers can send that out to folks as well. It's just a PDF. And I think, you know, the keys to success are you know, we've kind of heard that throughout the day. It's really the vision and the support of the state leadership. That was key, that we had that support. The direct involvement of the consumers and the providers, they were there at the table at the beginning. And then really building those partnerships between the housing agencies and the healthcare agencies and Medicaid, and just bringing everybody together to the table and not kind of bridging that abyss, if you will, and just kind of hammering home the message that housing is healthcare, and that's really what it's about. So that sums it up. So, you know, we're happy to take questions. I can pass it back to Steve, and he can handle that.
You bet. Thanks, Erin, and thanks, Larry. Really, really appreciate your thoughts. We have two questions on CSPEC. The first one, even though the services are not clinical services, is there a clinical supervision requirement?
Yeah, I can speak to that, and Larry can chime in. So they are required to be supervised by a licensed master's level clinician. So there always is a master's level person kind of overseeing the case. So, yes, there is clinical involvement.
Yeah, that's part of the standards that MBHP created with CSPEC initially. And so the clinical person is the backup and support, because the training for the folks who are actually providing the services vary, including people with lived experience all the way up to people with, you know, a master's degree. But often that support is needed, you know, folks dealing with serious mental illness. So, yes, that's a really important component of the sort of over arching services that are part of CSPEC, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks. And a question around the vouchers, and I know, Larry, you explained there's also some state-funded vouchers, but the question is, how are you getting by with using vouchers for people with a bad background history?
Yeah, so because a lot of the housing that we're talking about when people are placed out of shelter or even sometimes directly from the streets is managed by the shelters themselves, and sometimes working with private landlords, we have a very kind of a forgiving system around placing people with bad, you know, criminal records. You know, obviously we have concerns about, you know, very violent offenders and so forth. But generally, unlike, you know, the public housing authorities, which, you know, have some stiff requirements around, you know, background checks and so forth, we're often dealing with more of a private landlord. And because they know they can count on the services being present, that when they're willing to take, you know, some folks that, you know, have a kind of a checkered past, they're much more willing to work with our partners, ourselves, because they know they can turn to an agency that's going to be present in the event that, you know, there are issues that might arise.
Thanks. And, you know, I think I'll check with our housing colleagues, who I do not believe are on the line, but I believe that some local PHAs have standards that are more strict than the federal standards, and that they're maybe flexibility with your PHA, but that's something I'll loop back with the with our housing experts that are part of our partners and the program support team. One last question around, and this is actually for both states, and then we'll close out. We'll kind of do some closing logistics on the webinar. Are there any The questioner states that the strategies seem to be aimed with single adults, especially people who have experienced chronic homelessness. Are there strategies for people who are not chronically homeless, such as in relation to an opioid or heroin crisis?
Yeah, because of the, you know, we have so much data on how expensive serving the chronically homeless population is here in Massachusetts, where, you know, healthcare costs are probably higher than most places around the country. The real target has been on the chronically homeless for this particular program, and so we've sort of carved that. Oops, somebody's getting choked up here. we have been really focusing on this chronic population. Now, the pay for success program, which is a kind of a variation on the sort of the theme, does a vulnerability index screening. And so the length of homelessness in the PFS program, kind of they put a little different spin on it, but they're still looking at domains that indicate, you know, high utilization of emergency departments, you know, ambulance trips, detox, mental health services. So a person that's being targeted for PFS could have a less than chronic homeless history, but because of the screening that goes into getting into, and our housing advocacy agency, Aaron mentioned the Mass Housing and Shelter Alliance, they have a screening tool and sort of say pass or fail based on a score on that. So that gives the non-chronics a little bit of an opportunity to get permanent housing, which, you know, is a good thing for folks that, you know, have a lot of factors that contribute to high cost and high spend in terms of all of their needs.
Great, thanks. So I know we've only got a couple minutes left, and I want to move to next steps and really appreciate all our speakers today. The final webinar is going to be April 27. It's the same time, from 2:30 to 4:30 Eastern. We'll focus on implementation planning based on lessons learned from experienced states. We'll gather more. We've gathered more information from these two states. We have other states that we've interviewed or will interview to bolster that piece of it. We can have additional calls with small groups of states on particular topics of interest. I know the crosswalk is particularly complex, and that might be an aspect where we where states, you know, if there's enough interest from states, we can have a call about that. And more than one, if we need to, we can give you the support you need to get things together. And I know there's also a fair amount of interest on, you know, how to make the services work. And we can, you know, as folks have specific questions, let me know, and we can arrange some group calls to walk through those. We have one more polling question, and we won't spend a lot of time on it, but I want to get a sense, just to help us get ready for the implementation planning kind of webinar for the next step. You know, what do you expect to be the most difficult when implementing Medicaid housing services? Kind of what aspect of implementation? And there's a variety of options here, you know, kind of having provider capacity, provider billing, just getting good providers able to bill for health-related services, working with MCOs, provider standards, rate setting, measuring cost savings, measuring outcomes, prompt start of service, especially for individuals, getting individuals ready for service, or other aspects. We don't have a blank for you to explain the other, but we at least can know if these nine aren't capturing everything, we'll at least have a good idea of that. We've got a little more. The traffic seems to be slowing down a bit. I see a lot of results for rate setting. I think, Jenna, maybe we'll give folks just a few more seconds, and then we'll close the poll.
Yes, agreed. I'm waiting for a few more folks to roll in, and then we can go ahead. So if you want to finish up, and give and send in your answers now. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and close the poll in just a second to get your final responses. Thank you to all those that responded.
Thanks. Definitely seeing rate setting as an issue to cover, along with provider capacity and you know, a fair amount of other issues, start of service. Really appreciate that feedback, everyone. Thank you. Last slide. If you have additional questions, please email me. My email is there. Include the subject line tenancy so I can keep track of things well. I'd like to thank our presenters today. I'd like to thank Marty Nisley, Robin Wagner, and Aaron Donahue and Larry Gottlieb. Really appreciate everyone's time today. And thank you, everyone.
Thank you, Steve.
Thanks, Steve.
And after you close the webinar, wait for a survey, and please fill out the survey. Thank you very much.